Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we have part two of our conversation with Emily Moore, a senior researcher with the Sightline Institute in Seattle, as she highlights the challenges and promise of building much-needed electric transmission lines here in the Northwest and across the country. So here we go.
So I can just give you an example of a project just to maybe bring it to life a little bit. Right now, you may have heard that there is one transmission line being built, a brand new one, in the region, and it's called the Boardman to Hemingway line. It's being built by PacifiCorp and Idaho Power, also known goes by its acronym B2H. And it runs from Boardman in eastern Oregon to Hemingway in Idaho, and it mostly traverses eastern Oregon. And the point of the line is to take advantage of the fact that electric demand peaks at different times of the year in the Pacific Northwest as compared to the mountain states. So here, our electric usage peaks in the winter. That could change certainly in the future as our climate warms. But right now it peaks in the winter. And there in the mountain states, it peaks in the summer when people are using lots of air conditioning. So the idea for this line is it goes in both directions. And in the winter, we in the Pacific Northwest would be able to tap into solar and wind power from Idaho and Montana, and then vice versa in the summer. So, but it has definitely faced opposition. You were asking about that before we got on the call in terms of, controversies around transmission lines, which are very real. And this line was proposed first in 2006, and it is expected to be up and running by 2026. So a full 20 years after it was proposed. And, you know, I can't comment fully on whether the opposition was right or what specifically led to all of that delay. I do know that there were concerns that the line would impact the sage grouse. So I think that's something to take seriously, of course. But all to say is that these lines are not simple in any way because they cross so much land. They're complicated, and we can get into some of those barriers a little bit more, but I would say given all of that and given the urgency of cleaning up our electricity generation so that we, when we electrify everything, we're actually using clean sources, we need to start planning now to build those lines. If it's going to take, let's say it takes another 20 years to build another new line, then we're looking into the 2040s. And that's getting us very close to those deadlines.
Well, so once again, I think you did a great job of sketching out why the fast piece. And so my simple takeaway is that the utilities are almost like they're in this pinchers thing where the legislatures have told them you've got to do A, but to do A, they've got to get clean energy from east of the mountains. And right now it just takes, it seems like an inordinate amount of time to get those facilities built. So it's like it almost has a feel of a horse race to me. I mean, are we going to be able to do this in time or not? And if we don't do it in time, what then? But we'll talk about that here in a second.
Yeah.
So you mentioned barriers, and of course you've alluded to some of them, like there's environmental concerns. What are some of the other barriers? And as you speak about those barriers, how do we mitigate those barriers? Because clearly something has got to change here if we're going to be able to get installations in within less than 20 years. I mean, I think we'd really like to be able to do it in 8, 9, 10 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. There are a lot of barriers, but we can start maybe with a big one, which I consider to be a precursor to solving many of these issues around transmission. So that is that neither the Northwest as a region nor the state within it knows exactly how much more transmission we actually need to meet our decarbonization goals or where it needs to go. So in other words, there is no plan right now around this. And I was pretty surprised when I discovered that. You know, I kept searching around for where's our plan. And there really isn't one that A, takes a 20-year time frame, which I think is the appropriate one given those climate policies I just described, given our climate goals overall, given the magnitude of the change that we're talking about. And there isn't one that works backwards from the decarbonization goals. I think the plan is really important because I think if we got more clarity on where exactly how much more transmission we need, where it could go to avoid sensitive habitats to the extent possible, make sure we're respecting tribal rights, you know, ensure there's stakeholder involvement, all of that. The plan, at least in theory, could help with that. I think we know that we have a backlog. BPA, as I was mentioning earlier, Bonneville Power Administration, the big transmission player in the region, we know that we need more transmission because they're facing such a big backlog. They have been receiving more and more requests for transmission every year through this process that they run, where basically utilities and renewable developers request to connect to the grid. And most recently in the 2022 cycle, they got 144 requests, which was their highest ever. And most of those were for wind and solar projects. And they found that they could only accommodate 11 of those projects for, this is probably getting too detailed, but what's called long-term firm transmission, which is basically kind of the gold standard of transmission rights. Make sure your resource like definitely has access to the grid. And the rest would require pretty significant upgrades. So I say all that to note that we know we have a problem, but we don't actually know exactly how much more transmission we need, exactly where, et cetera. We do, you know, the closest thing that we do have to a plan is a 10-year plan that's developed by an organization called Northern Grid. And they are Northern Grid. It's a membership organization of BPA and 11 utilities from Idaho, Montana, Oregon, Washington, and Wyoming. And they're required by federal regulation to create a regional transmission plan. But the way it works is they basically work, they take each of the utilities' plans and combine them, and then that becomes the regional plan. And state policymakers and regulators have, you know, they can sit in on the meetings that Northern Grid has, but they don't have power, decision-making power, or much influence from what I gather in those. So it's very utility dominated and BPA dominated. And I think one of my big takeaways from all of this is that Northwest leaders need to can get more in the driver's seat of transmission planning. And I think they're starting to. I think this is becoming much more of a understood to be much more of a critical piece of the clean energy transition. But I think that Northern Grid plan doesn't quite meet what we need. But anyway, so planning, that's a big one, but there's a lot of other barriers too, which is why this can be difficult. I think we were talking a little bit with the other project about the local opposition and, you know, understandably transmission lines can be controversial. I think, you know, they're big pieces of infrastructure. Some people might consider them an eyesore. I can understand that. But in the past, many communities and landowners have put up a lot of opposition to transmission projects. So to give another example, in 2010, Portland General Electric had proposed a project called the Cascade Crossing Project. And it would have been a 215-mile power line that went from Boardman in eastern Oregon to Salem, in Western Oregon, and it sparked a lot of opposition. And I think, you know, much of it, again, I don't want to opine on whether the opposition was right or wrong. I think it's just to highlight the complexity of this. So the original route would have crossed over national forests and also through the Warm Springs tribal reservation. And some folks were also concerned that it would be used to transport coal-fired electricity from the Boardman coal plant, which actually was just demolished this year. So PG&E ended up changing the route of the project so that it wouldn't cross the reservation, but then it ultimately canceled the project entirely. So that's happened time and time again for, I'm sure, different reasons each time. But I think that is a real barrier, certainly, to building more of these lines. Another one is around permitting and siting. So as you may know, transmission lines are kind of unique in that because they cross so many jurisdictions, they have to get approval from each of those jurisdictions that they cross. So that could mean that a given line might need permits from or approval from multiple federal agencies, state agencies, and local agencies, depending on its route. So obviously that creates a challenge. And I think it's especially challenging when we're talking about longer range lines where certain communities or states might just be kind of passed through. They're not on the generating side or the receiving side. So, you know, you can understand why there might be more opposition from or more difficulty getting the permitting or the siting in those communities. But it is interesting because this is, as I was saying, kind of unique to transmission lines. If you take natural gas pipelines, for example, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, known as FERC, actually does have the authority to permit and site natural gas pipelines that cross multiple jurisdictions, but they don't have that authority with transmission lines. And that's kind of a function of how differently our electricity infrastructure versus our natural gas infrastructure was built out in the United States, with electricity originally conceived of or considered to be mostly a state or local issue, whereas natural gas was kind of understood, you know, we don't extract natural gas everywhere. So it's kind of understood as necessarily crossing multiple jurisdictions. So FERC was granted that authority. And so that's something that certainly is being discussed in terms of trying to change FERC's authority on that. But just that the complicated nature of getting approval from every single place where the line crosses, of course, adds to delays. And then the last one I'll mention is just around cost. I mean, these can be very expensive, these lines. They can be multi-billion dollar projects. So transmission owners have to figure out a way to finance them. And I think there's a question of if a line will benefit the entire grid, who should pay for it, and how do we make sure that costs are allocated equitably and also don't lead to big rate increases for ratepayers too, especially right now in time of rising energy prices. So it's certainly not simple, I guess.
Yeah, no, not the least bit simple. And I would say, I hate to say this, but it feels almost overwhelming. I mean, the challenges that are out there. So I'd like to bite off a little bit, a piece at a time here. So One of the things that you highlighted was the difference in the way permitting is done for gas pipelines versus electric lines. So did I infer correctly that you feel like it would be an important step forward if we could start permitting these long distance lines at the federal level rather than at the state and local level?
This is something I'm digging into right now in terms of how big of a challenge is this specifically in the Pacific Northwest, because I don't want us to be in a position where we're throwing away environmental protections or other important regulations that we have for a reason. But it does seem to me that it can be duplicative and overly complicated to have so many different levels of permitting. And so, you know, one thing that just talking about Washington specifically that I was learning about recently is that, so here we have what's called the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, which is better known as EFSEC. And I'm actually not sure when they were created, but they were created in Washington to be kind of a one-stop shop for siting and permitting. And I suppose in theory, and maybe in practice too, they can help manage all the different permits that are needed and streamline them, including streamlining the federal and the state permits and then the local permits too, if they're needed. But my understanding is that EFSEC, that process is not required for transmission projects. That's something I'm actively digging into right now, because I know there's a big conversation, of course, nationally around permitting reform. And I think a lot gets lumped under that bucket. And so I want to get a little more precise about, okay, here in Washington, what exactly, how exactly are permits, or is the way that we do permitting limiting transmission? But I do think that FERC should have more authority around transmission permitting and siting than it does. And actually, I should mention that one part of the bipartisan infrastructure law that President Biden signed last year actually did grant additional authority to FERC around permitting certain transmission projects that I think the Department of Energy deems in the national interest. Apparently, FERC actually had that authority, or was granted that authority by the 2005 Energy Policy Act, but it's never used it because it was challenged in court. So the infrastructure law kind of reasserts that authority. I think that is a good thing. I don't know how it will play out in practice, because they haven't defined the national interest corridors yet.
Understood.
We don't know.
So this is a kind of a curious aside on my part. So the way permitting is done in the Pacific Northwest right now, do the agencies have eminent domain authority?
I would need to look more into that. That's kind of top of my research to do right now, is looking more in the permitting stuff.
Okay, fair enough. So, so we've got this time crunch going on. And so what else? So permitting reform can play a part in that. Although the way you sketch it out, it's like, wow, it's pretty tough to find where you're going to find the extra space in there to squeeze it down a little bit. But, you know, you never know until you try, right? What else could you point to as possible speeding up this process? Because, you know, 20 years is just not going to cut it, really, right?
No, it's not. We don't have that kind of time, I don't think. So, well, I can mention a few things other, maybe to make us feel a little more optimistic.
Okay.
There are some positive changes underway. So this gets a little technical, but FERC, which I was mentioning before, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they're actually considering a new rule that will require regional transmission authorities like Northern Grid to start planning out 20 years ahead instead of 10. So we might actually get some progress on that planning point that I mentioned. I think they are reviewing public comments on that rule right now. They, I think the public comment period closed in September. But anyway, so like that seems, I think folks are aware around the country that this requires more advanced planning. Other things that we can do, I mentioned that FSEC point already. I think there's also, because it can be so challenging to build these brand new lines, we should also be doing everything we can in our power to minimize how much we need to rely on brand new lines. So there's a few things we can do on that. I mean, one is upgrading our existing lines. So there, you know, is potential for doing that. I think every study I've seen still requires some new lines, but certainly not like we need a bonanza of new lines necessarily. Like, let's be smart about it and judicious about it. So that's one thing. And then another one is around maximizing distributed energy resources. So that means things like rooftop solar, which again can reduce the burden on the grid. So if we're producing solar energy closer to where it's consumed, then of course we don't need quite as much transmission. And Oregon, from what I've, you know, study I read recently, Oregon could generate 34% of its electricity from rooftop solar, and Washington could generate 27% of its electricity from rooftop solar. And that's certainly much more than we are doing right now. So there's some potential there. So I think there's some other positive things happening. I'm happy to talk about, if you want, the infrastructure law, you know, some other aspects of it, and the Inflation Reduction Act too, which both allocate some money toward transmission. So I guess the good news is also this is getting certainly more attention than it was a few years ago. So I feel maybe cautiously optimistic that we will start to give it the attention it deserves.
So, yeah, so let's talk a little bit about IRA and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. So there's big chunks of money in that. I once again, I'm referring to your article. We're talking about billions of dollars. So what should we be spending that money on?
Sure. So, yeah, maybe I'll just run through what each of those does. So the infrastructure law, in addition to the FERC authority that I already mentioned, they also or it also directs the Department of Energy to create a $2.5 billion transmission facility program. And that's actually a revolving fund, which means that the DOE puts the money into a project and then it gets it back out and then it can reinvest. So it actually could multiply much more than $2.5 billion. And then the Inflation Reduction Act has three provisions in it related to transmission. So it has $2 billion in direct loans for transmission projects that are, again, located in the national interest corridors. So I think they're figuring out what that means exactly. And then it includes $760 million of grants to siting authorities. So I assume that would mean FSEC here in Washington to facilitate the siting of transmission projects. And then $100 million to convene stakeholders around transmission planning. So as to what it should be spent on, I mean, I'm hopeful that Washington and Oregon will be able to tap into some of those funding streams. You know, if we talk about, for example, the need for planning, if there's $100 million there, like, could we use some of that to help? And then another model, you know, we've talked a lot about BPA as the big transmission builder in the region, and the others are the utilities, really, who own the kind of other 25%. I'm curious if there's a world in which Washington or Oregon could build transmission lines themselves. And this is not something I've dug deep on, but it is something that a few other states have explored. So New Mexico has what's called NMRETA. So it's the, what is it called? A regional transmission authority. So that's a state entity that has invested in transmission projects. I think some of the models are kind of public-private partnership. And then Colorado just last year, actually, the legislature there passed or created a state transmission authority that I think will have the authority to build and finance transmission lines there as well. So anyway, my point is, could we use some of that funding maybe to start building some of that at the state level? Again, I don't know. There might be, the electricity market is very interesting in the United States in that it really looks different region by region. and the Pacific Northwest in many ways is very unique in how we, how our electricity market is structured. Not only do we have BPA as this huge federal entity, which most other areas don't have an equivalent of, but we also still have vertically integrated monopoly electric utilities, which many other regions don't either. So anyway, you can't necessarily compare apples to apples when you're looking for other ideas, but it's something I'm curious about. And I think that Washington and Oregon could look into those other models and see, is there anything we could do here? And I know folks, you know, in the Washington state government and agencies are actively trying to figure out how they can tap into the federal funding that's coming available from these two laws.
So if I heard you correctly, a little while back, you made reference to Northwest leaders taking a stronger hand with the Northern grid. Did I hear you correctly on that? And if I did, what could you flesh that out a bit?
Sure. So again, Northern grid, it was created in 2020. It had a predecessor whose name is escaping me right now. But anyway, it's a membership organization of utilities and BPA, and it is the only place where regional transmission planning happens right now. And the state regulators or policymakers, so for example, the Washington Utilities Commission, they are a enrolled party, quote unquote, to Northern Grid, but they are not a member and they don't have decision-making power. And from what I've gathered through informal conversations, it really is a kind of utility BPA run show. And in fact, actually, Washington and I think several of the other states that are enrolled parties to Northern Grid wrote a letter to Northern Grid earlier this year, perhaps last year, saying that the 10-year transmission plan that Northern Grid had put out didn't adequately reflect the state's priorities or policies. So I've never joined a Northern Grid meeting, so I don't really know how it works in the room, but everything I can tell is that our state leaders don't have a big role right now. And I think part of that is the structure of Northern Grid, but I think part of it is also not having enough capacity within the Public Utilities Commission to actually be, you know, actively attending and advocating for state interest in those laws, in those rooms. So, you know, one potential solution is investing in more state capacity to be able to actually join those meetings more, participate more deeply, make sure that whatever plan is coming out actually is consistent with the laws we have on the books in Washington and Oregon to clean up our electricity sources, and that we're not just kind of accepting at face value the plan that was created by utilities and BPA.
Yeah, that's just a really interesting situation. So if I'm understanding you correctly, we've kind of got this agency with a lot of power, but not really a lot of accountability to the folks that it's there to serve.
I think that's right. Yeah, and I don't even know if they technically, I don't think they're technically an agency, but yes, a kind of organization that, yes, it does seem like from all the conversations I've had with a variety of folks, they have pretty limited accountability.
Yeah, I'm just thinking it was probably at one point in our history. I mean, you've pointed out how things have evolved in terms of energy needs and capabilities and so on. And I can imagine that at one time this seemed like, OK, this is a fine way to do things. Mm-hmm. But time has passed and it sounds like it's time for some reforming of how that whole thing works. Anything legislation wise that you're looking at that you have some hopes or concerns about?
I have heard that Governor Inslee and his office will be proposing some legislation around transmission in Washington. So I don't know the details of that yet, but as part of CETA, the Washington's Clean Energy Transformation Act, that the legislature passed in 2019 that I was mentioning before, our clean electricity law, the legislature directed FSAC, there's so many acronyms here, FSAC, which is the siting authority. In any case, that's not the important point. The important point is that there was a working group over the last year that was formed at the direction of the state legislature that looked at transmission in the Northwest. And if any of the listeners are really, really interested in transmission and want to go deep, all of the recordings from those meetings are online. So if you just search Washington Transmission Corridors Working Group, you'll find them. And they just released their final report of recommendations, some of which I think touch on what we've, some of the ideas we've talked about today. And that report is delivered or was delivered to Governor Inslee and to the legislature. And my understanding is that Governor Inslee and perhaps some legislators, I'm not sure about that side of it, will propose some legislation in the upcoming legislative session that starts in January that addresses some of that. So we're certainly keeping our eye out for that. But the report, I think, is an interesting read, and the meeting recordings are kind of interesting because they do bring in a bunch of different experts. It was a multi-stakeholder kind of working group with folks representing all types of interest groups, and they brought in folks from BPA, folks from the utilities. So if anybody's interest has been piqued, that's a good place to go.
Well, we'll certainly pay attention to that legislation as the season comes up. So I got a couple just off the wall things that have occurred to me here, and we're about out of time, but our long distance electricity transmission, is there any, there must be a reason why it can't be underground.
Well, this is the question I've gotten before, actually, and I want to look into it. So I'm from California originally, and I was actually just talking to my mom, and she was telling me that PG&E, which is our big utility down there, and our power lines have caused a bunch of, their power lines, I should say, have caused a bunch of wildfires.
Right.
And part of that mitigation effort is that they're burying a bunch of lines. So I'm actually very curious about that too, John. I don't know. Is it way more expensive? Probably. It's something worth looking into. I do know, so I haven't heard of one being proposed underground here in the Pacific Northwest, so I'd be curious to know why that is. I don't know the answer, but I do know that there's a group, there's a company that is proposing a transmission line actually underneath the Columbia River, which certainly raises for me some environmental concerns. I don't know. I haven't looked into it. But their part of their reasoning is that it is so hard to build these big structures over land because they spark all kinds of opposition. So they, I have the name of that project. It's not being built. And I think, of course, there's lots of things that would need to be answered about that. But that's the only one I've heard of in the Pacific Northwest that would potentially be underground.
Yeah. Well, I'm just a little bit relieved because before I asked the question, I was like, this is probably really a stupid question. So it's reassuring.
No,
to me.
It's a good one that clearly I need to look into. I was trying to remember the name of that one, but I don't have it in front of me.
So. I'll look it up and put it in the show notes after the fact. So one other off the wall question here. Do these high energy transmission lines, are they ever built down freeway median strips?
Yes. So, I don't know if they're built in the median. That's interesting. I'm not sure. Maybe. Maybe in certain areas of the country. But I do know that one of the recommendations that came out of the report that I was just mentioning from the working group, the Washington Transmission Corridors Working Group, was to look at siting these lines along highways or transportation corridors, which I think could make a lot of sense, especially one of the constrained kind of areas of our grid here in the Pacific Northwest is the I-5 corridor.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I haven't done the detailed studies on whether that's feasible,
right.
or whether we already are kind of at capacity there. But I do know that they recommended as part of that work, more siting near or on kind of transportation rights of way.
Well, maybe we're in a tight enough spot here that people really start exploring for, let's call them, out of the box possibilities or different ways than we've been doing it in the past. So I got one last thing I wanted to ask you here. You've tossed out a lot of resources for folks that want to dig in a little deeper. We'll put links to those in the show notes. Anything else you want? I think that as individuals, as voters, as citizens, as consumers of electricity, we can benefit by doing our homework, quote unquote. Anything else that you want to toss out for folks to take on as individuals?
Hmm. Yeah, well, this isn't super concrete, but I do think there is an important shift happening in the climate space right now. It's something that Bill McKibben has been talking a lot about, if you follow his work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that, you know, historically we've been focused on stopping all these dirty infrastructure projects, and we need to kind of reorient as a movement to keep doing that, certainly. Those projects still exist, but also start to accelerate or build a movement around clean energy infrastructure. And I think that's actually a lot harder to do. So the reason I bring that up is because I think that local voices can and should have a big impact on whether these lines get built. So I think as these projects hopefully get proposed more frequently in the coming years and decades, not to give them a carte blanche, but also not to kind of automatically reject them, and instead to evaluate them on their merits. And certainly, I think, as with any big infrastructure, there's pros and cons, and I think we have to look at the big picture to decide how we feel about them.
Yeah, so I think that that's an important distinction. It's kind of like the negative and the positive of the thing. So mm-hmm. we do tend to fuss about the problems in our energy system, but the promise of a clean energy system is pretty wonderful with good jobs and good communities and healthy communities for me above all else. So mm-hmm. There is certainly the promise of all of this stuff has got its positive aspect to it. And so for right now, that's where I'm going to be focused. So Emily Moore of the Seattle's Sightline Institute, so great to have you with us. Thank you for all the time. I learned a lot, and I know our listeners have learned a lot too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, John. I appreciate it.
Many thanks to Emily Moore for the work she's doing to help us as laypersons, as well as policymakers, to understand the challenges and promises of a cleaner energy system. Today, we focused on the need for significantly more transmission lines in the Pacific Northwest, but the same is true across the country. Estimates are that we'll need to double our transmission capacity if we are to be able to get the renewable energy promised by the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 from where it's generated to where it will be consumed. As of now, we aren't on track to get there, and our awareness and involvement will be a factor in determining if we do. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. A bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all the other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.